The court. My name is Lauren Whitley with the Richmond Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Holman. Probationers in the Commonwealth of Virginia, when released, are stripped of a large number of their constitutional rights, but they do maintain a few under the 14th Amendment. Those do include the right to a notice and a hearing when allegations of their probation are brought, and the right to confront witnesses against them or evidence against them unless good cause is found to waive that right of confrontation. Mr. Holman had both of these rights violated in his probation violation hearing before the Richmond Circuit Court. The first assignment of error that we have brought addresses the violation in the trial court essentially admitting hearsay evidence or confrontation evidence under the 14th Amendment in violation of Mr. Holman's rights. Specifically, the trial court in this case did not engage in any of the required analysis as laid out under Henderson against Commonwealth from our Supreme Court, well, Morrissey versus Brewer under the United States Supreme Court, Henderson, and then as further direction given by this court in Cox against Commonwealth.
Ms. Whitley.
Yes, sir.
If ends of justice don't apply on assignment of error two, and that's waived, where does that leave you with assignment of error one?
I still think the error in admitting that evidence was harmful. It was not harmless. So when we talk about the evidence that was admitted that was hearsay evidence in this case, or was evidence that violated Mr. Holman's confrontation rights, it's a couple pieces of significant evidence. It's that he didn't report an arrest in a timely manner. It is that he moved residences without permission. And both of those items of evidence are specifically referenced by the trial court when he renders his sentence.
Was the residence issue, even if that was testimony of hearsay, was that cured at all in your client's testimony?
No, because...
He then says that, yeah, well, my mother got scared, and that's...
But then he specifically testified that he had told his probation officer he was moving residences. So that contradicts, essentially, what the probation officer's report, the prior probation officer's report, established. And he also said that, because what the allegation was that he moved residences without permission. I think that a fair inference is from what he said is that that contradicted some of what the probation officer was reporting about moving residences without permission or reporting to be living somewhere but then not having lived in that place. Mr. Holman's testimony actually established that he was informing his probation officer that he was moving residences or living in different places. And what happened in this case essentially is that the trial court, from this record, appeared to be under the belief that hearsay and probation violations was always admissible, and essentially that confrontation rights did not apply or attach. And that's evidenced by the trial court statements at a couple of different points. This is a unique case procedurally because there was a trial. Mr. Holman was acquitted of that trial. The probation violation was originally scheduled to be heard immediately subsequent to the trial hearing. However, there was a continuance because Mr. Holman was disputing some of the allegations in the probation violation report. And the trial court said at that point after the trial, and I'll quote, "You guys aren't following revocation proceeding. Hearsay of every kind is admissible." He says this again a few statements later. He specifically speaks to the major violation report being all he needs in order to go forward on a violation.
Do you agree that we can look to see if there was sufficient evidence that would justify a good cause finding, even though the trial court didn't specifically make one?
I actually don't, because of the way that this court laid out the procedure in Cox against Commonwealth. Because the court made clear on the record that it did not engage in its own reliability determination, I would argue the only course of action before this court is to remand it and direct the court to apply that analysis at a new hearing.
But what wasn't that a holding in Cox? I mean, how do you distinguish Cox?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that as in Cox here, one, I guess a subsequent argument is, or subsumed by that, is I don't think this record would allow the court to make that reliability.
But I just want to see where our starting point, which seems to me, that we use our independent review of the record.
And I guess, Your Honor, I would argue that my reading of Cox, I think in Cox as well, the Commonwealth conceded that record didn't support engaging in that independent analysis. But I think in reading Henderson and Cox together at this stage, that if a trial court does not engage in a good cause finding, I don't believe the procedure allows this court in every case to then engage in that finding itself. I think the proper procedure is to remand it back to the trial court to apply the required analysis.
Was Cox a case where the record was simply silent, as opposed to this case where the court obviously made an erroneous ruling?
In Cox, the court as well made some statements on the record that affirmatively showed it did not engage in the good cause analysis. And I believe this court stated in Cox that those statements dispelled any notion, was the phrase used, that there was a good cause analysis that was had or finding that was made by the trial court. I believe the trial court statements were something to the effect of, we accept probation reports from other jurisdictions all the time, this is very standard, and then moved on to listen to the evidence that was under dispute. And we do have a very similar situation here with this trial court. Again, at the hearing when the specific objection was raised, the trial court made those affirmative statements once again, you know, denied, I'm admitting it is hearsay, it is admissible. He actually goes on to cite, maybe one of these days you'll get the folks up the food chain to buy that argument. Right now, I don't think it is valid. So certainly this trial court believed that all evidence, despite being confrontation evidence, testimonial hearsay, was admissible at revocation hearings. Mr. Holman would argue that at that stage, this court should remand it. But even if this court were to look at the record to see if there was evidence to determine the reliability of these statements, there is not. So we have this probation officer who left the probation office July 11, 2016. We don't know why. We have no statements or evidence about the reliability of this previous probation officer. If there had been some testimony or some engagement about, well, I've had this officer in my court for a number of years, he's always very reliable, but we don't have anything like that from the trial court or from the probation officer who testified.
Is what happens once reported on intra-office, is that testimonial hearsay?
Yes, in this case it is, because it is conversations that are being reported for the, I would argue, for the purpose of litigation, but also through numerous conversations. So we don't just have, as the Commonwealth asserts, a simple, they didn't show up to a meeting. We have, they didn't show up to a meeting, and the probation officer goes on to say that, well, they were moving residences without their permission, for example, in this case. It goes on to say that Mr. Holman was intentionally misleading him. And that is certainly something above and beyond a simple failure to show for a drug screen, failure to show for a meeting or moving residences. We're talking about interpreting and writing a report to the court that is going to be used to send Mr. Holman back to jail.
Was all of the major violation report objected to or just portions?
I believe the objection was to the portions that the probation officer who testified did not have personal knowledge of.
And when Judge Root ruled, he referred to the violation report is enough to me, but he didn't refer to which portions he was talking about. He just referred to it generically.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And there were some other allegations.
Restitution.
There was an allegation of restitution, and Mr. Holman, in his testimony, essentially admitted that he had not been paying the restitution. He was explaining he had child support. He was trying to support his family. However,
I think he said he gave some either to his girlfriend or something like right. that out of the goodness of his heart.
He did.
Something that a trial court could either accept or reject as reasonable.
That's correct. Absolutely. And we're not saying that there weren't other violations or technical violations that existed that this probation officer who testified had personal knowledge of. But the ones that were testimonial hearsay that did violate the confrontation clause were significant and affected the sentence. And that's why this is not harmless.
Let me ask you, if you had a police report, mm-hmm. wouldn't that be considered sufficiently reliable that at least it would come in at a revocation hearing?
I would state not necessarily, Your Honor. I think it depends on what we are purporting to use from that report. I think it depends on if there's corroboration of the report or contradictory evidence. In this case, there was contradictory evidence. Mr. Holman and his girlfriend, Ms. Barnes, testified that they had both informed or that the probation officer was aware of his movements between his sister and his mother's house.
Said the opposite, didn't she?
Well, that was part of the challenge of the testimony of hearsay, certainly, is that conversation was had by the prior probation officer, then reported by the second probation officer. But I think the court can look to Henderson, where the Supreme Court actually talks about a number of situations where we might have reliable out-of-court hearsay for probation violations. Police reports, affidavits, corroborating evidence, circumstantial evidence that, you know, contributes to the allegation.
I guess I'm wondering if a police report generally is in a revocation hearing, why wouldn't a probation officer?
And I guess, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that a police report in and of itself. I would argue it would depend on the circumstances and what we have. If there's evidence admitted by the defendant contradicting the content of that police report, then I would say that's not reliable. If it is a police report where we're reporting witness statements, so for example, in Henderson, the detective testified to witness statements, but then the detective's testimony was corroborated by the defendant's own statements, by his gang affiliations, by other allegations and circumstances before the court. So I think there needs to be something more. And I think this court in Cox made clear that a probation officer's report in and of itself does not cure any constitutional violation in its admission.
Can I ask you about your second assignment of error? And I'd like to address the merits, not the procedural default argument that the Attorney General has made. We had a similar situation in an unpublished case, Anderson versus Commonwealth, 2016 opinion. And I know that it's unpublished, so I want to really rely on the cases that it relied on. But it basically held that revocation can be based on uncharged conduct or conduct which resulted in an acquittal. And it relies on Slayton versus Commonwealth, a 1946 Supreme Court case that says that there's nothing that stops or precludes a circuit court from inquiring into the facts that resulted in an acquittal when determining whether to revoke probation. Why don't those cases, and I think another case, Virginia versus Pinnell, where the Supreme Court held that the applicable standard in a revocation hearing is preponderance of evidence, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Why don't those cases defeat your argument on the merits?
Because we're not actually arguing that the evidence of the arguably bad behavior is inadmissible. We are saying that the procedure used by the trial court in this case was erroneous. So our argument is not, and that those cases certainly stand, you can introduce simple evidence of bad behavior. So the evidence from the trial, even though Mr. Holman was acquitted, could be admitted in his probation violation hearing. But the procedure that was used by this trial court violated his 14th Amendment right to notice in a hearing. So what Hess says, and that's the case we rely on, a published case from this court, what Hess says is that you can't have a judge simply announce that he or she is taking judicial notice of evidence presented in another proceeding over which he or she presided in which the defendant was a party. So in Hess, the trial court presided over a trial in absence, a misdemeanor trial. The defendant was convicted and then later presided over the probation revocation hearing that relied on that conviction to revoke the defendant's time. And this court said, the trial court, while saying, I heard the case, you know, I know what your daughter said about the automobile, that did not specify the evidence that was being relied on that he was using to revoke the suspended sentence. So here we do have the trial court saying, the end of the trial, I hope you've told your client that I'm going to rely on what I heard here. He says both at the end of the trial and then at the end of the revocation, I was 95% sure of your guilt. I heard the trial. You know, I'm revoking based on that as well as the violation report. But the trial court never says, I find that at the trial, Mr. Holman, you were dishonest with this court when you said that the phone was given to you. I find that the complaining witness was credible when she said that you stole the phone from her, and that bad behavior is why I'm revoking, in part, your suspended sentence. So it's that's missing. That's more of our argument.
So my belief that you are, in fact, guilty of this, even though I couldn't find it beyond a reasonable doubt, not that 95% couldn't equate to that, but that in your opinion, is not detailed enough.
Absolutely not.
My belief in your guilt of that criminal offense.
Absolutely not, because Mr. Holman has a right to defend himself, just as in the trial. If there's a specific piece of evidence that the trial court plans to rely on.
You're well into your body.
I am. I think that goes back to why we have those minimum rights. He has the right to defend himself, and that, of course, requires he be notified of what he's defending himself against. Thank you.
Mr. Campbell?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. If I could touch upon Simon of Error 2 first, since that's where we left off. Unlike Hess, the defendant was actually present for his trial for larceny. He was given notice at the end of the trial that the judge was going to consider everything he heard at the larceny trial, at the revocation. Unlike Hess, the defendant made no objection to the judge doing so, either at the trial or at the revocation hearing. He made no objection. Their argument, as I understand it, is that the judge didn't follow the correct procedure for considering other evidence that occurred at a trial under the Hess decision. Whether or not he did that or not, that does not rise to a manifest injustice, that procedural deficiency. And we would argue that assignment of error would be barred under 518, and that the trial court's consideration of what he heard at the larceny trial, that his conclusion that he was 95% sure that he was guilty, is the law of the case going forth. Turning to assignment of error 1, I think it's probably important to lay out some groundwork here.
You agree that the trial court was in error when he said all hearsay is admissible at a probation violation hearing?
Right. I would say that is an error of law. That certainly hearsay is admissible.
Not all hearsay.
not all hearsay, no. If I could just lay out some things here. Probation Officer Reed was the one who authored this report. This report, it covered 11 months between October 2015 to September 2016. Mr. Reed was his probation officer starting in July 2016. There was an objection to anything that he did not have personal knowledge of. And I took that objection to mean that anything that occurred under the first probation officer's watch. And I think those are two things that we probably cover under this probation violation report. And that would be the October 15th move by the defendant without his probation officer's permission, and the April 2016 failure to report his arrest within 3 days. If I could just speak specifically to both of those. As for the failure to report the arrest, he has never challenged that he did not do that. Also, I have a real problem classifying that as a testimonial statement for confrontation purposes, because it's essentially a business record that he reported this arrest in May of 2016 and the probation office made note of that. Not even sure that the previous probation officer was the one who actually made note of that, but it was someone in probation made note of that. I do think that we can start in this case from the looking at the record and determine whether or not there is a good cause to admit these two records in this case. Unlike Cox, the Commonwealth does not concede that there was not good cause in a record for this court to de novo determine whether or not good cause existed to waive his confrontation rights. Specifically as to the April 2016 failure to report an arrest, we would argue that that is a reliable piece of evidence. It is a government record. It is also something that was that this officer, Officer Reed, obtained from someone within his office. And under cases like Dickens and Saunders, and the footnote in Saunders, that government records are should be deemed reliable in terms of probation revocation hearings.
On the good cause, can I ask you on that? I mean, yeah. At one point, the trial court says, I was going to proceed with the matter on the last time I have him in here on a new charge. You guys write a detailed report, and that saves me having to have you be here. The more detailed it is, the less likely anybody is asked. Is it your position that that's actually a finding of good cause?
Right. Yeah, that is our position, that that is at least an implicit finding that of good cause, that he was finding good cause to consider the whole probation violation report based on that statement and his actions in denying this the objection on hearsay grounds. Regardless, I would say that it's harmless error, at least for both of these, but I'll continue to go talk about the April 2016 matter. Again, he never challenged that he did not report his arrest within 3 days. Also, the trial judge said in ruling that the larceny trial was alone enough to revoke him in this case, and that should be enough to determine that this was harmless error if the court considered this. As for the October 2015 move without permission.
So basically the fact that there was a trial on larceny at this point would be enough to revoke the cause.
Yeah,
it's an act of grace, essentially, and so that's enough to revoke the act of grace.
Yeah, and that's what the court said. So that alone was enough for me to revoke you, and he actually reiterated that when he wrote his report. on page 90 of the appendix, because he went above the guidelines in this case. As for the October 2015 move without permission, again, this was a record that the probation office had that he reported after he had moved that he had moved. And it's important to remember that the violation is that he did not seek permission before he moved. And he continued to do that. He continued to just move and then tell his probation officer after the fact that that's what he did. We would also argue this is reliable.
Is there corroboration implicit in that when the defendant testifies that, yeah, this is why my mother said that I moved or something like that? Obviously, the probation officer wouldn't be going to see his mother if he or she thought the defendant lived somewhere else.
Absolutely, and that was my next point, is that we had the testimony from him about not denying that this conversation took place between him and his mother, that because she was on probation too and was worried about the probation office visiting him. And he admits that he went and moved with his sister at that time. And then his girlfriend talked about how he moved around a lot. Defense counsel admitted that during the closing argument that he moved around a lot. And the whole point of this violation was that he failed to maintain a stable residence. And the evidence bears that out. There was two other times in August 9th and September 8th where he moved again without permission from his probation officer, and that probation officer would have been Probation Officer Reed at that point.
Again, was there sufficient evidence in the record to revoke him on the issue of restitution?
I believe so. I don't recall all the restitution facts, but if I recall...
He conceded that he hadn't paid it.
Yeah, he hadn't paid it.
He gave the excuse that he had child support. Said that the rest of my money, I think it was approximately $300 a month or so, but I don't recall specifically the number, that he gave to maybe his girlfriend for support of her child out of the goodness of his heart or other family members.
And the point was, he was not making restitution. Yeah, he had a job, but he wasn't making restitution. And he was moving around a number of times without his permission from his probation officer. He did not show up for meetings. He did not report his arrest like a month afterwards. And also he had the larceny charge, in which the trial judge presided over and determined that, I don't know why 95% is different than for reasonable doubt, but nonetheless, he was almost convinced of his guilt. But that was enough to revoke him.
Just
sit on
that 95.1 threshold.
Right. I mean, if the court were to decide this second thing on harmless error, I would say it's cumulative. I mean, because the violation is he failed to get his probation officer permission to move.
What about the amount of time the court revoked? If we were to say, well, the court erred in assignment of error number one, but assignment of error number two is waived, and that's sufficient to support revocation, do we necessarily conclude that as a corollary, and it also is sufficient to support the punishment imposed?
So is the question that he would have given him less time if he had not considered...
I mean, we don't know
everything.
So what do we do?
I think in this case we have... he certainly, on page 90, where he talks about why he sentenced him for what he sentenced him for, it kind of explains his reasoning. And he said... It was a loan, and not, the larceny stuff was a loan to revoke him and go above the guidelines in this case. And really, the guidelines, he got 3 years active time. I think he got 13 years and 10 suspended, 10 months suspended. So we're just talking about like a three-year active sentence. And I'm not sure that...
Yeah, I guess what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that the judge pretty much said that I'm loading you up because of your your larceny acquittal, not because you didn't report to the probation officer.
And he made statements on the record. He goes, that's how I felt right after that larceny trial, and that's how I feel now. And I'm even more convinced now that this is the right thing to do.
And not, and again, that they went through this with Ms. Whitley, not all of the major violation report was objected to. There were some technical violations that were not contested in there.
No, that wasn't. The only thing that he objected to was this sort of broad, nothing that Mr. Reed had no personal knowledge of, which I would guess would be the stuff that would be under the first probationer's watch, is my understanding of that objection. But again, those two things were something that he never even challenged, and this other thing about moving, in which he listed that two other times on the Mr. Reed.
Can I ask you the same question I asked Ms. Whitley? And that is that if you have a police report in a revocation hearing, wouldn't it normally come in?
I think normally it would be considered reliable.
And if so, why wouldn't a probation officer's report normally come in?
I think normally it would. I would say maybe there would be things in a police report in which a police officer would be investigating something and interrogating someone that might be in violation of someone's confrontation rights. I kind of agree with Ms. Whitley on that point. There may be something in a police report in which there is a sort of the equivalent of interrogation that could be a confrontation clause problem. In this, we don't really have that at all. We don't have any sort of what we traditionally understand as investigatory.
So what the previous probation officer said about what the mother told him and those sorts of things, that's not a...
I mean, the stuff with the mother, I mean, it's kind of a red herring in my opinion because, again, the defendant basically corroborated that there was this conversation and also that really wasn't relied upon by the trial court. The whole point is that he just wasn't seeking permission before he was moving his residence. Unless the court has any other questions, I just ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Kim.
Thank you.
Ms. Whitley, you have your rebuttal time?
Yes, sir. I just want to start out with a quick quote when the trial court makes its findings about the sentence, because I do think that the reason this is harmful is because of what the sentence was. He says, put it to you bluntly, this is on Joint Appendix 117, if I had 15 years and 10 months hanging over my head, I'd be calling in every day just to make sure everything was squared away and they knew exactly where I was, this place, that place, or some other place, not reporting any arrests right away. So the trial court clearly relied on these hearsay statements in rendering the three-year sentence. I direct this court to Whitehead and Turner from the Supreme Court, were also probation violation cases where there were technical violations that were not reversed, but the Supreme Court said we don't know how they affected the sentence and remanded those cases. Turner for a new sentencing hearing, I believe Whitehead for a new revocation hearing. I'd also point out that the major violation report is not a business record. The title of it is Major Violation Report. It is written to be used in the purpose of revoking someone's suspended sentence, to inform the court about someone's conduct on probation for the purpose of possibly being used against them in court. And I think that that is a dangerous scenario where we're accepting these then as business records and not testimonial statements, especially when you start looking at the content of what's in those reports. And this one in particular, the previous probation officer made a kind of characterized what the actions of he was alleging Mr. Holman did as intentionally misleading him. I think that is far and above some independent, you know, phone record or something that is not affecting the trial court's ultimate determination. And again, we're not asking for trial courts to require police officers or probation officers to show up. What we're asking for today is simply that they go through the process that is due probationers and consider whether there's good cause to waive those rights. And that's what we're asking this court to send it back to the trial court to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whitley. We will recount.